Got a loaded episode of the podcast today. Cade Cunningham is back for the Detroit Pistons. The Thunder and the Pistons both clinched the top seeds in their respective conferences. We talked about Doc Rivers and his Google me comments to the Bucks locker room. My depleted all-NBA ballot. If no Luka, no Wemby, no Anthony Edwards, no Cade, we're talking about that. And then I get into some stuff that I'm hearing about the NBA general manager's meeting, including an idea that I think actually might solve tanking. And then later in the show, got some Blazers interviews, Donovan Klingon, Denny Avdia. We got a lot to get to. Let's get to it right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We got a good one today. Joining me, as always, every Thursday, Tom Avestro. Tom, how are you?
I'm doing great, man. How are you?
I'm doing really good today. I'm excited to podcast with you. We're going to talk about a whole bunch. I've heard some new stuff from the NBA GM meeting that we'll get to in a bit. But we got to start out with what's happening at the top of the league in the NBA right now, because Cade Cunningham's back. The Pistons clinched the one seed in the East. The Thunder clinched the one seed in the Western Conference as well. So we're starting to get some clarity at the top. And I'll tell you what, Tom, the fact that Detroit continued playing as well as they did without Cade Cunningham, not something I expected to happen. I thought the Celtics might actually catch him. I worried about how the Pistons would look without Cade, but Jenkins and Duren, this team has stepped up in a monstrous way, and just got to hand them and JB Bickerstaff, that entire team, for a excellent season overall, especially closing out the one seed the way they did without Cade.
Yeah, and Cade looked pretty good in his first game back. You know, not playing at 100% clearly, but when you get back from a collapsed lung, you saw what you needed to see. And it's a nice landing spot for the Pistons playing against the B-League, the Milwaukee Bucks, with their starting lineup out in this game. Someone hit me up yesterday and said, "Tom, the Bucks aren't tanking. How dare you? They're just trying to preserve our value." And I'm like, well, that's a form of tanking when you're pulling your best players off the floor. I'm pretty sure the NBPA has an opinion about this. And again, it's one of the worst defenses I've seen in a while. I felt that way when the Blazers played the Bucks a couple weeks ago. I just thought there was no rim protection, just no resistance whatsoever. You're watching these highlights. I mean, they've got AJ Green as like the low man on the half of these plays. They scored, I think, 66 points in the paint. 32-2 advantage in the fast break column. Just not a competitive game, right? And that's what you hope to have with Cade Cunningham coming back from a partially collapsed lung, that they can kind of get back in an exhibition game. And that's what it was. So a really good ramp up game here for the Detroit Pistons. And Jalen Duren, we'll talk about it later probably, but he's had one of the most impressive seasons around in the NBA. When Cade Cunningham was off the floor dealing with this injury, he had some of his best games of the season. And like you said, they didn't miss a beat without Cade Cunningham. It makes a lot of these MVP arguments and first team all NBA arguments really tricky, because as much as you want to put a player in that first team all NBA or in that MVP conversation on the outskirts of it, some of the way that these teams have been playing without that guy, like in the case of Cade Cunningham, really muddies the picture, because you would like to think that without Cade and the engine of that offense, it didn't really seem like they missed a beat. And a lot of it has to do with Danis Jenkins and Jalen Duren and a bunch of others on that squad just stepping up. But that's really what it comes down to, is JB Bickerstaff has done a hell of a job coaching this team. You could say the same for Joe Mazzulla, same for Mitch Johnson, with all the stuff that they have been dealing with this season, and OKC, like all the injuries they've had. It's been a weird year, but Cade Cunningham coming back was a great sign for the Pistons and a great story and a great season for JB and the staff.
I mean, it's an amazing story for the Pistons to go from the bottom to the middle to now the top in the Eastern Conference. I mean, it's a pretty crazy three-year improvement that they've experienced, from 14 wins to 44 wins to possibly 60 wins if they win their last two games. And you mentioned the embarrassment that is the Milwaukee Bucks on the other side of that game of Cade Cunningham's return. That team's just horrific. And I very much enjoyed the Shams Charania story this week about the Milwaukee Bucks, specifically about Doc Rivers, where Shams said how in a team meeting this season, according to Shams, said six people in the room, that Doc Rivers said, "Look at my resume. Google me. I took teams in the playoffs and to the championship that weren't supposed to be there. Look at my resume." And it wasn't received well, as you would completely expect. I mean, I wonder if this is just all building towards Doc Rivers either deciding to retire, go back to golfing and podcasting and broadcasting, which all of which he's very good at, or if this just results in the Bucks firing him and hiring a brand new head coach with a clean slate, Giannis trade, clean slate moving forward. I'd imagine it's going to be one of those two things or some combination.
Yeah, he's not being shy about this at all. Like, you watched his press conferences. Even when he got the job, he was doing media availability saying, "I don't know why they hired me. I told them not to hire me." And now he's openly saying at the end of these games, "Yeah, I haven't seen my grandkids as much as I'd like to. So, you know, this is take it for what you will. But I've got so many grandkids I want to spend more time with." So, yeah. It's just very transparent. A lot of the stuff that Doc Rivers says is, you know, you kind of roll your eyes at the lack of accountability on some of the things. But on his employment status, he's not very shy about talking to the real about him taking this job in the first place and whether he has a future with the Milwaukee Bucks. It was a trying season. And for the organization, the story that Shams Charania put out there, and it's not very often you see Shams do like a 4,000, 5,000 word like magazine story. It's just very rare to get that kind of information. And there's so much in there. The Nike detail that Giannis wanted to play, and there's a clause in his Nike contract that he would get a big bonus if he played at least 41 games, and they held him out. The NBPA filing a complaint and having a league investigation, and there's a mix up in stories. But it's the six sources, Kev, it threw me. It was like Shams be like, "I didn't just hear it from one person. I didn't just confirm it with a second source. Six people came to me and said, yeah, that's what happened." And I can imagine in that locker room, they're all just like, "Okay, Boomer, get on with it."
I'm sure Doc is still going to deny it, as he often will. He's a great liar. So that's the Milwaukee Bucks. We talked about the one seeds being locked up. The two seeds are pretty close. Celtics and Spurs have effectively locked into the two seeds, but the Spurs right now are dealing with an injury. Victor Wembanyama has a rib issue. Luka Doncic is in Spain for his injury. Anthony Edwards is dealing with a knee issue. We have a lot of star injuries towards the tail end of this season, Tom, and you've been on top of this the entire year, how it's really not just a load management story, it's an injury issue that is causing players to miss so many games. What are your thoughts right now on Wemby's status in regards to the 65-game rule, whether he comes back, and what we're looking at now with a depleted All-NBA team?
Yeah, the real worry here is that the 65 game rule is compelling players to return faster than they should in order to get to that 65 game rule. And we saw it with Tyrese Haliburton a couple years ago, how he admitted to JJ Redick on his podcast, like, "Yeah, I returned way faster than I should have, probably against medical opinion, because I wanted to get that big bonus in all NBA and getting, you know, basically getting that bonus and being eligible for all NBA that season." And then 2 years later, he's torn his Achilles in a deep playoff run. I'm not saying that he tore his Achilles exactly because of that rule and rushing back and the hamstring injuries that happened afterwards. But you can see around the league, if Wemby takes a shot to the ribs in his final game here because all the players on the opposing team know that he has a rib contusion and he's trying to play through the injury in the postseason run, and then he's out for a while, That's a catastrophic outcome for Victor Wembanyama and the NBA. And you look at Anthony Edwards, we hear about how all these guys are trying to get to that 65 game plateau, but Anthony Edwards was like, "No, I'm not." So in his case, it wasn't a big motivator to continue playing through injury. So it's not as clear cut to say that these guys, they care about these awards and they want to get to 65 games. Because in the case of Anthony Edwards, he just said, I'm not right. I'm not. I don't care about the All-NBA eligibility because ultimately I don't want to mess anything with my knee. And for Victor Wembanyama, he has a different calculus, and Luka Doncic is going to apply for this extraordinary circumstances exemption. And it sounds like Cade Cunningham might do a similar thing. It can't be a success if last year there was 1,000 star games lost due to injury, and this year we're approaching 1,500 or 500 more games lost due to injury than last season to star players. You cannot tell me the system is working when star players are missing that many more games, and the calculus is simply, yeah, I'm going to pack it in halfway through the season, or I'm not going to go for that 65 gamer because I'm trying to win a championship, and this is not helping my postseason chances. And God forbid we see another string of Achilles tears in the postseason like we saw last year, because that's what I think a lot of GMs, a lot of medical professionals in the league, the coaches and the players, that's the cost, right? You can say, hey, these guys made it to 65 games and otherwise they might not have. Nikola Jokic, Victor Wembanyama, I'm naming those guys. But let's wait until this postseason before we do a victory lap about the 65 game rule.
Look, I think the 65 game rule is complicated. In some regards, I think it's a good thing that players are incentivized to try to get back instead of milking their time away. That's good for the fans, but it's also going to be bad for the fans if guys are rushing back too soon, leading to further injury or diminished performance. But what's clear is when I fill out my All-NBA ballot, if there's no Victor Wembanyama, there's no Luka, there's no Anthony Edwards, there's no Cade Cunningham, and I look at my 15 guys on that ballot, and I just don't see a representation of what is the story of this entire NBA season. So let's take a look at that ballot with how it would look if there's no Wemby, no Luka, no Ant, no Cade Cunningham. First team would be SGA, Jokic, Jaylen Brown, Donovan Mitchell, Kawhi Leonard. Second team, Kevin Durant, Jamal Murray, Scotty Barnes, Jalen Brunson, Tyrese Maxey. Third team, LaMelo Ball, Jalen Duren, Chet Holmgren, Jalen Johnson, Denny Avdia. I'd consider Devin Booker. I'd consider Alperen Şengün, Bam, Gobert, Harden, Towns, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, Derek White. There's other guys on that consideration list. This is not a final list, and because it's not final because we don't know who's going to be eligible yet. We won't know until Sunday when the 65 games all wrapped up, or the 82 games are wrapped up, and we find out who hit 65. But I look at this, Tom, and I'm like, that third team, I mean, Denny's had a good year, and Jalen Johnson's had a good year, and Chet's had a good year, but like some of these guys, I'm like, I'd much rather put on Cade and Luka and Wemby with 62 games and 61 games or 64 games than some of the guys on that third team.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with everything you just said there. And I agree. Denny, Jalen Johnson, LaMelo. I think I might have Jalen Duren higher on my board than third team. I think I have him on second team as of now.
Fair.
But that's
totally
that's
fair.
Also with Wemby, Luka. Like assuming Wemby and Luka and Cade and Ant are not on the team, it changes things dramatically, like you're pointing out. And I can understand if this was year one of the 65 game rule, and the argument would be, hey, after this, everyone's going to recognize, hey, I got to take myself more seriously in the offseason, get ready for the 82 game season. And if I really want to get this All NBA award, I got to really take care of my conditioning and my health in the offseason and really be aggressive in maintaining my health through the 82 game grind. We're what, 3 years into this? 4 years into this? And it's going in the opposite direction. We're seeing star players get more injured and the All-NBA teams get more diluted because of this rule. So I just feel like it's bad for the PR. I mean, we saw what it was Victor Wembanyama on ESPN last night on Wednesday night, no Stephon Castle. And I was listening to my guy, Mike C. Wright on SportsCenter say, look, Stephon Castle's just taking this game off for rest. Yeah, he's just getting rested up for the postseason. And that's not considered like load management, but this is exactly what the NBA didn't want, is guys taking games off strategically to get ready for the postseason in a national TV game. And as I wrote last week, just 33% of national TV games have the full complement of stars. It's, I just feel like the NBA and the NBPA have their head in the sand when it comes to the 65 game rule. Star players are missing way more games, having way more serious injuries. And I can't look at just because we see Victor Wembanyama trying to get to 65 games and Jokic trying to get to 65 games. I can't see that as like, I'm going to ignore the elephant in the room is that star players are playing only 60% of their games this year.
The 65 games doesn't hit the exact issue right now, which is the fact that with the style of play nowadays, players are taking more steps, more hard steps, more hard pivots, more wear and tear on their bodies. And that likely is what's leading to this uptick in injuries. I don't think it's just that players are softer than they were in the 90s and in the 70s. I don't think it's that. I think it's the nature of the game today. I think it's the nature of medical science as well today. That's why you are seeing players get held out more often. So it is a little bit of that as well. But I think largely it's about the nature of the game and still that combined with the length of the schedule that's leading to all of these injuries over the course of a full season. And that's too bad because I think the game as it is beautiful. I love the style of play we see in the league today. I love seeing these athletes play this free-flowing, fast-paced game using every inch out on the floor. It's a beautiful game, truly. But that's where I think it's tougher for the league to talk about these things, why it gets back to, as you've talked about, Tom, removing back-to-backs, see how that helps injuries, right? That seems to be like the number one thing the league can do to help out here is just remove back-to-backs. Let's start there.
Yeah, remove back-to-backs. That increases the recovery. And we should use that word better, more often than rest. I think the NBA could do a lot of good PR by changing the vocabulary around this issue. Because by describing it as a rest issue, it really demeans all the strength, conditioning, the discipline that these players have to go through in order to endure an 82-game season with the game and the geometry of the game and the three-point shot just totally warping all the closeouts and the hard moves. And the Ben Taylor did a great video this week for Thinking Basketball on YouTube about how the game today has completely changed and why it's so more rigorous to play in today's game than it was in the 80s and the 90s, and the hard movements, the hard pivots that is required on these closeouts and these Euro steps and the D-cells and the step backs, all of these movement patterns are creating a lot more issues. And I just think you're slapping a piece of gum in the Hoover and a crack in the Hoover Dam with the 65 game rule. I think it just draws more attention to the injuries rather than to the strong play and the amazing play by these players. When every time you praise someone, you have to say, well, but they're three games away because they missed so many games due to injury. So I feel like you're right. The game has gotten way more problematic for these bodies, that they cannot withstand the rigors of this game and the speed and the three-point shot and the up-and-down nature of the game, that the freedom of movement that the league office wanted. There is a cost to that. And the tax that these players are playing and the league partners and the TV broadcasters are paying is that we just don't see the best players on the biggest platforms and the fans don't get to see them nearly as much. And so take away the back-to-backs. And I also think finding a way to, how do I say this? Finding a way to praise players for playing a lot of games rather than punishing players for not meeting a 65 game arbitrary rule. Like, let the voters decide if 62 games from Luka Doncic is better than 66 games of Jalen Johnson. Because I really think it is insulting to the voters that we can't do that math for ourselves.
I think that's a good way to put it, Tom. Let's talk about this week's NBA general managers meeting. It seems like the league has kind of honed in on concept one. If you remember three or four weeks ago, the league leaked out three concepts that put out different types of possibilities for NBA lottery reform. Concept one is the one that's picking up traction. I'm told this is the one that they are solely focused on at this point with some expected changes. And as a reminder, what concept one is, 18 teams would be in the lottery. The bottom 10 that missed the play-in, plus the eight play-in teams. The bottom 10 would have flattened 8% odds each. The next eight teams would split the 20% remaining in descending order, and all 18 of those spots would be drawn as part of the lottery. These things are negotiable. It's possible it wouldn't be 18 teams as part of the lottery. It's possible it could be 22. It could be 14. It's possible that they don't draw all 18 spots. It could be only drawing the top 10. Things could change. The 8% flat might end up 6% or 7%. There's a lot still to be discussed, but concept one, this general idea, is where the team is looking right now, Tom. And I have some real concerns about 18 teams. I think having 18 teams in the lottery creates two cliffs. There's a cliff within the playoffs where if you're a 5 or a 6 seed, you have incentive now to tank into the 7 or 8 spot, because then you get 2 games to stay in the playoffs and you get your lottery ticket. There's also a cliff at the edge of the play-in. If you're that team in the 10 spot, you're looking at far less significant odds of moving up in the lottery than if you're one of the bottom 10 teams. So you have even more incentive to fall out of the play-in in order to get one of those bottom 10 spots, when under this proposal, the 10th worst team has the same odds as the worst team, 8%, of getting the number one pick in the draft. And one of the other things discussed during this GM meeting, I'm told, according to the people I spoke to that were part of this meeting, is that there is some pushback against 18 in favor of 22, which would mean having all the teams that missed the playoffs in the play-in, the bottom 10 teams, the 4 teams that lose in the play-in, so that gets you to 14, and then the 8 first-round exits with more flattened odds, because that removes those cliffs that we just talked about. It would allow more flattening. You could do something along the lines of like 6% flat for the bottom 10 teams, 5% for the 4 play-in teams. You could do then descending like 3%, 2% for the next group of teams. I think something along those lines is more appealing to me, but I'm curious about your thoughts, Tom, on 18 versus 22 before we get to my actual idea and something else that I heard that really stuck out to me, but I want to hear what your thoughts are first on 18 versus 22.
The cure is worse than the disease. What I'm hearing from this 18 team, or 22 team for that matter, you're going to see, I think, would be a huge PR problem for the league. An amazingly bad PR problem if teams are tanking out of the playoffs. We're basically saying we would rather teams tank out of the play-in, tank out of the playoffs, and have a shot at winning the lottery. These flattened odds are going to be a worse look for the league. When, let's say, you're a team that's down 0-2 in a series in the first round, just bag it. You're going to see this. We've seen extremely emboldened tanking strategies already by just saying, you know what, screw the play-in. We're not going to do the play-in this year. We're going to make sure that we get these odds out of the play-in, and you see the stratified league, you're only going to see that more with this. The 10 teams, if you think the bottom 10 teams are stratified now in the NBA, the A-League versus the B-League, wait till you see this. It's going to look like child's play compared to that, because if you have an 8% chance at having to winning the lottery with the 10th worst record, but it goes down to 2% or 3% or 4% at the 11th, you're going to see a ton of teams trying to vie for that bottom 10 group. So you won't see acute losing at the bottom. I would argue I would rather see 4 teams being outright terrible than 18 teams where you're not sure if they're trying to win games. And that's what I think is going to create, is teams in the play-in, we're not sure if they're trying to win, because if they lose, they get a shot at 8%. And that, to me, is a worse look for the NBA. The more teams that you don't know if they're trying to win because they might be trying to tank into the lottery is worse for the league, not better.
So do you like 22 more for the reasons I described, being able to flatten it a bit more steadily, 6%, 5%, 3%, something along those lines?
I want all the playoff teams. You don't have to think about it, whether they're trying to win. You're going to see so many more sweeps when a team goes down 1-0 in a series. 2-0 in a series, they're just going to lay down.
No playoff team is going to intentionally tank. It's not going to happen. I think it is so unrealistic that a team is going to tank out of the playoffs in the first round for 2% odds, 3% odds. It's just unrealistic.
I mean,
if they were going to tank out of the playoffs, they would have done it during the season anyway. To get
well, teams are going to try,
or 6%
teams are going to try, but there's only so many teams that can get into the bottom 18 or the bottom 22.
I just don't think you can convince a coach or players to do it during the playoffs. I think during the regular season, it's a hell of a lot easier to do that. But if you would flatten 22 with 22 teams involved, 6% for the bottom 10 versus 3% or 2% for playoff losers is not dramatic. It's not as significant.
I hear what you're saying, but look at what we're doing with the Milwaukee Bucks with Giannis, where the star player is saying, I want to play. I'm healthy. He's an MVP candidate.
But they're out of
the
playoffs. They're out, though. They're not in the playoffs, though.
But you could see a team. Is
he really healthy? I mean, there's so much like contrasting information about that, Tom, right now.
For sure.
It's hard to know what the truth is in that situation. I don't think the league actually knows what the full truth is there. This is a couple bickering at each other, breaking up. I don't think it's the most relevant example, honestly, with everything. It's so much drama.
What I'm saying is the eye of the beholder of I'm injured, I'm healthy enough to play. If you're a team down 0-2 in the playoffs and your star player is really banged up and you're potentially trying to hold them for trade value in the offseason, or you can get a lottery pick out of this, I think teams are going to have a much harder discussion than it is now about, like, is it really worth it for us to trot out, let's think of Anthony Edwards or someone like that, when their knee is banged up and you're down 0-2 and you got blown out in the first two games? The calculus for sure, Kev, is going to change. And we've seen it in the NBA that it's not tanking with the players on the floor. It's organizational tanking. It's corporate tanking. It's, hey, guys, we need to be smart about Giannis Antetokounmpo and his calf injuries. We don't want him to tear his Achilles in the game 4 when we could potentially get a lottery pick out of this. And so I think the math changes for guys, star players, who are on the fringe of being healthy enough to play in a playoff game when they're down 0-2. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. So, all right, let's say that's all true. It creates a more explosive relationship. Because if a team is saying that to a star during a first-round series where they're only down 2-0 and they still have a chance to win, that player is going to be forever insulted and probably want out. I just don't think a team, they can try that if they really wanted to, but I don't think that's ever going to go over well with the coaching staff or the players in that locker room. It would forever tarnish a relationship during the playoffs to do that. In a winnable first-round series versus the regular season, players get it's a long year. You need to take time off. You need to maintain your body for the playoffs. Once you're there, I just don't think it's a thing. But there are people in the league who do feel the way you do when it comes to having 22 teams involved. Now, this is what's interesting. This has not been reported yet, but I talked to a number of sources that were part of this call. There was back and forth discussion about 18 versus 22 teams. And then there was conversation about, well, what about the bottom 3 teams in the league? There was one general manager who said, what if we don't allow the bottom 3 teams to get the number 1 pick? And Adam Silver and the league kind of pushed back against that. It's too extreme. Nobody's really going to sign up for that. It's not going to happen. And then another GM came up with an idea that I think is brilliant. What if you just have the bottom 3 teams with slightly worse odds than the group after them? What if you had the bottom 3 teams, say, with 5% odds, and then the teams that are 4 to 10 with 6% odds? So that way, there would be no incentive to bottom out entirely. You'd be fighting to get out of the bottom 3, trying to win games to have the slightly better odds in the 4 to 10 spot. Suddenly, situations like the Seth Curry situation this week with the Kings intentionally fouling him, it became this whole thing on social media about the Kings were tanking, when in reality, Doug Christie was just trying to get his use it or lose it timeout before it hit 3 minutes. But that conversation would shift from nefarious tanking and the objectives of a franchise to just bad coaching. I think you'd have the Wizards playing Trae Young and Anthony Davis, trying to win games to get out from the bottom three, that to me is a very, very fascinating idea where you don't take away their ability to get a top pick. You just de-incentivize being at the bottom. And that means if you lose too much too early, you don't want to lose too much too early in the season either. Because then you might not be able to dig yourself out of it. I think it incentivizes winning in ways that I had never thought about. But that was something brought up by a GM this week. And my understanding is that Adam Silver responded positively to that, according to the people I talked to that were on that call, that he likes the idea. The league is taking that into consideration. What do you think, Tom, of that idea?
I love it because I hate any system that incentivizes losing. I hate it. It's a horrible look for the league. And any system that says, hey, all the teams that are trying to win, you're not going to have a shot. But all the teams that are going to try to lose, you're going to have a much better chance at a generational talent. So if the bottom three teams are going to have less incentive to lose, that's great for the league. I think they should just, you know, Kev, I'm not going to go there. It feels like I'm beating a dead horse here, how they need to disentangle the draft delivering the best prospects happening to the worst teams. Yeah. You're going to continue having this conversation. And that's why I feel like your suggestion here, or the GM's suggestion about lowering the incentive to lose, is what we need to do. All of this stuff, introducing playoff teams, winning teams, to have even a thought of, wait a minute, is this the, should we be thinking about this, about whether we really want to win this game? Just take that out of the equation and the whole entire NBA product gets so much better. It's not going to be worse. It's going to be better if you don't have all these teams where you have to think about it. Do they want to win this game? It'll be so much better for the league if we don't have to have that conversation at the end of the season.
I mean, can you just imagine some of these games at the end of the year between these tanking teams? It would be so exciting to see them fighting to win. No worries about fan bases. Wouldn't be happy they lost. It would all be about winning and winning. And this is why what brings me to my reform idea, based off of the conversations I had, based off of what the league is angling for with the concept one. Have 22 teams in the lottery. Bottom three teams get 5% odds. The next seven teams get 6% odds. The four play-in losers get 5% odds. The eight first-round exits get odds of 4%, 3%, and 2% in descending order ranked by seed. I think something like this type of smoothening and flattening, you don't want to be all the way at the bottom. You still get better odds if you miss the playoffs. But it's not such a significant cliff that you're going to see teams tanking out of the play-in, tanking out of the playoffs. It's very subtle differences between each of these levels. I think something along these lines would get rid of tanking in the immediate future. Obviously, things can change in the past. But if you look at each spot, just to look through this again, you're penalized at the bottom three, 5%. Spots 4 to 10 get 6%. Spots 11 to 14 get 5%. Spots 15 and 16, the lower seeded round one exits, get 4%. Spots 17, 18, and 19 get 3%. Spots 20, 21, and 22 get 2%. You can tweak these a little bit if you want to, but this is what I came up with to get us to 100% for the lottery. What do you think about this, Tom, after kind of talking through it? I know you're iffy about 22 teams, but what if this concept is something that was on the table for the vote on May 28th?
All right, so I guess it would just incentivize teams to get into that 4 to 10 range, because essentially if you're 17 versus 10, you double your odds at getting the number one overall pick. Essentially what you're suggesting here, Kev, and I'm not opposed to this, is flattened odds for the bottom 22 teams in the NBA. Just everyone has basically the same, whether it's 6% or 2%, you're all going to have a 1 in 20% chance, 1 in 20 odds in getting the number one overall pick. And we're not, what you're proposing here is not all that different than just saying no lottery at all, flattened odds for the entire NBA. And that, in terms of a thought process, is everyone in that scenario is just going to try to win as many games as possible because people love winning. It's a competitive sport. The GMs, the owners, they all want to win if you just flatten the odds entirely and you don't have this conversation about whether each team is trying to win. So I'm for either getting rid of the lottery altogether and just having a completely flat draft lottery. So even if you're OKC and you're winning all these games, you're going to have the same shot as someone else. And it's a very minuscule shot. But, you know, we don't have the tanking conversation at all. And that's what I thought was going to happen when Adam Silver came out here and said, we're going to stop tanking, full stop. Like, we are going to do something about it for next year. I don't feel like the proposal is anywhere near what it's necessary to get rid of tanking. So I just feel like there's some dissonance there, Kev. Like, I'm more for your proposal there than what I've seen already as the most momentum in the league. Because that, it really falls short of what I thought was going to be a more extreme and comprehensive anti-tanking measure. I just think you're going to get a lot more teams tanking out of the play-in tournament and then going to the bottom 10 teams. And so I think your proposal solves that.
I would hope that the league moves towards more something like that. Like I said, whoever it was on that call that brought up the bottom three teams as like having no incentive at number one, I do think that's too extreme. But the follow-up idea of just having slightly lower odds, I think it's awesome. Like, if the NBA can't do relegation, it's never going to happen with the A-League and the B-League, as you've talked about for weeks now, Tom. That's not going to happen. But if you can have slightly lower odds for the worst teams in the league, oh my God, there we go. Eureka. That's it.
It's soft relegation, right? It's soft relegation. Yes. Is if you want to be really bad, there's a cost to that. Instead of the opposite, which is here's your reward. Victor Wembanyama, Cooper Flagg, the number one overall pick. Even if Zachary Risacher is getting coaches decision, DMP coaching decisions right now, still moving up from 9, 10, 11 to the number one team for being bad. We don't want that in the league. And so I think you're right. This is the way to go, is to Adam Silver said we are going to fix it, full stop. I don't see how the 18 team rule is going to address that. I just think there's going to be even more of a stampede to get into the bottom 10 than what we're seeing.
And what I like about the idea that I pitched is that the four play-in losers have the same odds as the bottom three teams, 5%. So like these teams that are in the middle still have pretty good odds overall. That's equal to the teams at the bottom of the league. Let's move on to a little bit of news here. The Bulls this week fired their front office. Arturas Karnisovas and Mark Eversley are out. Their owner, Reinsdorf, had what I thought was kind of a bizarre comment during his press conference where he said, if the new GM doesn't want Billy Donovan as head coach, he's probably not the right choice for us. Tom, what general manager wants to get hired to a new gig and keep the existing head coach? I mean, what are we even talking about here? Reinsdorf, during this whole presser, is talking about we want to do things like Oklahoma City and learn from other teams. Well, clearly, I mean, you're just talking. That's what it is. You're just talking. That was my takeaway from this whole presser. And I feel zero confidence that a franchise that has been stuck in the middle for basically 25 years now, that has gone through Gar Forman and John Paxson and Arturas Karnisovas and Mark Eversley. It hasn't mattered who the GM is. It's the Reinsdorf family that's the problem. And you can't fire the owner. This is an ownership that just wants to be stuck in the middle just to get their two playoff home games, and that's all they care about. And that's what sucks for Bulls fans and sucks for the league, that this once proud, amazing Bulls franchise is just a middling, forgettable team at this point. And it's because of Mark Reinsdorf.
Yeah, it's leadership starts at the top. And when you're talking about trying to attract the best talent for your front office, but saying you can't decide your head coach, you got to keep Billy Donovan, is not a way to attract the top talent. Imagine if you were trying to go to the Bulls and they were like, hey, we love you, everything about you, but we don't trust you to hire a head coach. We're going to do that for you because we've been doing this for so long, been having so much success. Look at all the success we've been having under Billy Donovan. That's going to be your head coach. And nothing to take away from Billy Donovan. As a chef, you're only as good as the ingredients you're given to, right? But Billy Donovan would be the first to recognize that for a top-down organizational structure, this is not how to do it. Remember, it was Daryl Morey who took over for the Sixers, and they were like, you need to keep Doc Rivers as the head coach. And look how that went for Ben Simmons and the rest of that organization, that run with Daryl Morey and Doc Rivers. It's not a good model. And I think it's representative of the ownership problem in Chicago, that, man, without Michael Jordan, what would the Chicago Bulls organization be known as? It would be the Sacramento Kings.
Terrible. And like, I think for Billy Donovan, he's in a tough spot because he had some interest in the North Carolina job. Michael Malone, former Nuggets head coach, after spending a year as broadcaster, has been hired as North Carolina Tar Heels head coach. This kind of surprised me a bit when the news first broke. He clearly wasn't their top candidate. They went through, you know, the Brad Stevens names. They tried to get some of the top college head coaches as well. Dusty May from Michigan, national champions. Nothing there really was going to happen. So to get Michael Malone, it's going to be fascinating to see Malone, who's coached in the NBA for 25 years now since he was an assistant in college, getting an opportunity with UNC. His daughter is there on the volleyball team. She was there during the presser. Going to be interesting, Tom.
I actually really like this hire for UNC, and not just because I have a Wake Forest jersey behind me. This is, I genuinely think Michael Malone is going to do great at Chapel Hill. I think he's more, his energy, his disposition, the way he coaches, he's a throwback coach. And I think it might work a lot better in college basketball than in the NBA, where in college basketball, you might be the highest paid player in or personnel in that locker room, where the NBA, they might be like, dude, I'm making $50 million a year. I don't need to listen to you. In the college ranks, it's a little different. The coach has a lot more weight and leadership. And yes, that tide is turning with NIL and all the money that's being thrown around to the players. But I do think that Michael Malone is a great hire for Chapel Hill. And he has the connection with his daughter being a student there. So he's been on campus and understands the culture there at Chapel Hill. It is, I think, something you're going to see a lot more of, is the line between whether this guy is a college coach or whether he's an NBA coach. You could have a strong gap between those two groups of people. Now, because of all the money involved and that there are, you know, we're trending towards a collective bargaining agreement between players and the NCAA or some sort of much more NBA professional system, that I think guys like Michael Malone are going to say, all right, you know what? I actually think college is going to be best for me at this point in my career. And you're going to see a lot more back and forth, Kev.
I'm right there with you, Tom. It's going to be interesting to see with Malone. I can't wait to see how he does there. Hopefully it goes better for Malone with basketball than it has for Belichick with football. Really rooting for that, at least. It's always good when UNC is good in basketball. All right, coming up, we have conversations with Donovan Klingon and Danny Avdia from the Portland Trailblazers. All right, now joining us today from the Portland Trailblazers, Donovan Klingon. Donovan, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing great today. Tom Haverstraw got a package in the mail this morning from the Portland Trailblazers. What's in there, Tom? What do you got?
Yeah, I just literally got this off my doorstep. So it is a red box, okay? And I will open this up. DC, do you know what's in here?
I got a little bit. I got a little look at it. But.
Okay. Well, this is the first reveal. It says, vote Donovan Klingon for all defense. All right. Oh, it's a lock and key with a pen involved here. All right, let's see. I'm going to check this out. It says, paint lockdown, one of three players, Donovan Klingon, 500 plus defensive rebounds and 100 plus blocks, along with Rudy Gobert and Victor Wembanyama. A daunting lockdown defensive presence around the rim and on the defensive glass. Trailblazers big man Donovan Klingon has established himself as an elite defender during his second NBA season, ranking top 10 in contested shots, blocks, defensive rebounds. He's had an offensive held offense opponents on lockdown all season long. So I guess I have to open this key or open this lock with one of these keys here. Is that what I have to do?
I think so. I think that's how it works.
Did you have part of the planning process here, Donovan?
Not really. You know, I just left it up to the team, and I know they're going to figure out what looks and works best.
You just handle your business on the court, right?
That's it.
Donovan, I mean, like, for you, with protecting the rim, is there an art to defending the rim in the way that you have with the progress you made this season?
I feel like the biggest thing for me this season versus last season was, I feel like last year, we got it unlocked. last year was, I was following a lot more. trying to, you know, block shots, and it was leading to me getting more fouls and following out of games quicker. And this year, I feel like, you know, I learned with my size and my presence that I was able to, you know, just more deter shots with my hands straight up rather than trying to swat and block every shot. You know, sometimes they're going to shoot it right into my hands. And, you know, it worked for me to be able to stay on the floor longer without fouling. And, you know, it's my arm straight up. It's like 9'7". So, you know, for people to shoot over that is difficult. So, you know, it was a learning process, but, you know, it's been going well.
Yeah. Staying on the floor has been a huge thing for you this season, not just with the fouls, which is kind of a subtle way that a defensive big man can really make his presence, is being able to deter shots without fouling, but also conditioning and playing in as many games as you've had, Donovan. When you're as big as you are, and how many miles you've had just at UConn winning 2 national championships and coming in and playing every single night basically in the league, what did you do this offseason to put yourself in position, and this season, during the season, that you may have not done last year or coming into the league, that really propelled you into this position where you are an all-defensive candidate here with this lock, unlocking a lot of your defensive potential?
I feel like just focusing on my body, like you said, my conditioning, you know, making sure my weight was where it had to be, making sure I had the strength, and, you know, really just getting in long workouts in the summer that really, you know, pushed me when I was tired, where I had to, you know, keep going, and, you know, just being able to, you know, just consistently be productive, you know, through long stretches. And, you know, I feel like that's something that I'm continuing to work on, is, you know, being able to be as productive in the fourth quarter as I am, you know, in the first and second quarter, where, you know, I'm a little more fresh, and, you know, but, you know, really just focusing on my body, focusing on my conditioning, and, you know, just
like, what was different? What is different about your diet or your sleep or your conditioning, like drills, anything different that you changed this year?
I feel like, you know, less snacking, you know, more just getting more protein and more meals in. And, you know, really, I feel like even on off days and practice days, you know, getting that extra conditioning in just to, you know, stay consistent and, you know, keep my body where it needs to be.
What's the snack you cut out?
I mean, I was a big Cheez-It guy. I love Cheez-Its.
Oh, like what kind of cheese? It's like, what flavor ones?
White cheddar.
A white cheddar. Oh, I see. I'm a standard of like the toasted ones. Toasted, I
think.
Yeah,
oh yeah.
No, I've been cutting those out as well. I'm trying to lose this belly. Tom Haverstraw found some stats about you that I'm going to read out here. Total misses defended around the basket, offensive rebounds, and second chance points. You lead the NBA in, and all of those. Is there a stat you'd like to lead the league in one day?
Rebounds, just overall rebounds, you know, just rebounds per game. You know, I'm 7'2", 7'3". You know, being able to grab every rebound in my area is something that, you know, you got to do as a big man. So, you know, really just trying to snatch all the rebounds in my area.
Yeah. Is there a player that you emulate? Whether it's a player in the league now or one that you grew up watching, that you're like, that's the guy that I want to be like him when I'm an NBA player, because he plays the game the way I want to play.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, Shaq's dominance in the paint was, you know, something you've never seen. Even, you know, one of my fellow UConn guys, Andre Drummond, the way he rebounds the ball, you know, in his prime, and still to this day, you know, he's strong, he's aggressive, he's always in the right position. He's always crashing the glass offensively, defensively. And, you know, just being able to be relentless on the glass is something that, you know, I take pride in.
I mean, Donovan, what's fascinating about you is when you were, you know, in college, there was talk about like, oh, Klingon wants to be a shooter again, like he was a little bit in high school. And then in the NBA, here we are, you're shooting nearly 40% from three in the 2026 calendar year. What has gone behind is extending your range, improving as a 3-point shooter, and what's the motivation in adding that to your game when you're already a dominant interior finisher? What's the benefit of adding the 3-pointer to your skill set as well?
I feel like it spaces the floor for the offense. It gives guys like Denny, Scoot, Shaden, Tumani, Drew, you know, all those wing guys, point guards to get downhill. If, you know, I'm able to get in the corner, get on the wing, be on the top of the key and drag that big man out of the paint. You know, especially for guys like Denny, you know, Denny gets downhill and he's attacking. And if I could take guys like Rudy Gobert out of the lane and drag him out to the corner or to the wing, you know, that just gives him an extra advantage to finish.
Yeah, little deep cut here. Full disclosure, Kev, I play basketball, high school basketball in Connecticut too. I was in the FCAC, Donovan.
All right.
Lost in the States in the second round to hard hitting New Britain. And, they were number one seed my year back in 2004.
That's so, when I was born.
Making Tom feel old.
This is great. I thought we were vibing here, Donovan.
No, we are. Right. I'm just going out there.
So in 2021, against Northwest Catholic in the, I think it was the division tournament or the CCC tournament, you had 36 points, 27 rebounds, and 5 blocks. You got the win, of course. But what your coach remembers, Tim Barrett remembers, is how you opened the game with 2 3-pointers that you took against Northwest Catholic. And he tells the story that John Mirabello smiled on the sidelines, the opposing coach, because he just was like, come on, man. Like, are you serious with this guy's skill? You do this in the NBA now. I mean, on the broadcast, me, Lamar, and Calabro will be like, yo, he just hit 4 threes on Jokic in the opening quarter of the game. What is up with that? Like, you're incredible in the first quarter. Like, is there a story behind like how you just are hot in the first quarter? You want to establish your presence, but you're like Steph Curry in the first quarter, dude.
I feel like I shoot a lot of threes in warmups, you know, prior to the game, and some days they're falling, and yeah, you know, I just try to carry that over into the game. You know, sometimes slows off in the second, third, fourth quarter, but, you know, really just trying to find my rhythm. You know, biggest thing of me is having the same shot every time, you know, the same form, the same release point, holding my follow through. And, you know, I feel like if I could do that, you know, there's a good chance of it going.
Yeah. Have you had any conversation with players when you hit those shots or they say something to you like, dad, I didn't know you could do that?
Yeah. The other day, Valanciunas was like, man, stop making these threes in my face.
He can shoot too, though. I know.
He got one.
So you grew up in a household of hoops where your mother played at Maine alongside Cooper Flagg's mother, and they were best friends growing up. You knew Cooper Flagg, and now you had a chance a couple days ago to play against him at the NBA level. You've said before that your mom taught you a lot of little things about, you know, being a good basketball player and the right way to play, and that's helped you become the player you are today, is because your mom was able to teach you the right way to play. I'm wondering if you could tell all the young bigs out there, all the young players who are trying to learn like how to be an NBA player or how to develop, are there any tips that your mother gave you that has always stayed with you about drills or how your energy is on the floor or anything that you can, that she taught you that you want to impart on the younger generation?
One of the biggest quotes she always told me was, defense wins ball games and offense sells tickets. And, you know, I feel like that really still with me, you know, being a defensive presence, you know, defending the rim, rebounding, and really just she always told me to leave it all out there. You know, like every night you should be exhausted after the game. You know, you should be feeling sore, because, you know, you gotta leave it all on the floor. You gotta get everything you got for your team and try to help the team win. And, you know, those are just some things that, you know, I live by and could, you know, put in my head before every game.
Yeah, I feel like when you watch Donovan play, there's a lot of physicality. Did your mother teach you that too? Is just like, oh, yeah. Was she a bruiser too out on the floor?
Oh yeah, I mean, she was 6'4", so, you know, she was very physical out there.
You just came off a game against, of course, Stephon Castle. He ducked you because he didn't want to play against you in this game on Wednesday night. But you did get a chance to play against Nikola Jokic. Can you talk about what it's like to defend Jokic? We saw Wemby in that shot try to defend him in the overtime game, and just what it's like to have to guard that guy, and what are you trying to take away?
There's, you know, I feel like he sees everything 30 seconds before it's going to happen. You know, his level of IQ is through the roof. You know, his passing ability, one hand, right hand, left hand, you know, his touch around the rim is, I mean, I don't know if he's really missed any any shots within, you know, 5-6 feet. You know, but just his touch, his footwork is really special. You know, he just got so many parts of his game that, you know, you really have to focus in on and try to lock down.
Well, what are the things, so like with a guy like Jokic or Wemby or yourself, I mean, there's so many bigs that shoot threes and handle the ball at this point in the NBA. What are the things that you've had to improve at since you entered the league in order to be able to defend effectively on the perimeter on top of having to protect the rim inside?
Yeah, moving my feet, my footwork, being able to slide my feet, you know, keeping a strong base, being able to, you know, wall up at the rim as guys are driving downhill, keeping an eye in hand. And really, I feel like you learn certain players, you know, tendencies where, you know, if they want to drive right, if they're going to spin back, if they're going to Eurostep, you know, you just got to learn over time what certain guys like to do. And, you know, I feel like that, those are some things that really helped me.
What are some things you do as part of that process when it comes to scouting? Are you watching film? Is coaches giving you tips on what a player likes to do?
Yeah, I feel like it's a little bit of both, you know, watching my own film. And, you know, before every game, obviously watching a scout and certain guys that I'm at the guard, and, you know, trying to pick up little things that, you know, some people don't see, but it's something that will, you know, help me defend and win the game.
What about running the floor? Like, that seems like something that you pride yourself on, is just getting back offensively and defensively. As an NBA big at your size, I think people had questions about whether you could keep up in today's up-tempo NBA style. But what is it like to play in the NBA now and see how fast the game is and being able to not just keep up with it, but thrive in that role?
Yeah, you know, defensively, you know, as the big guy who's in the paint, you see everything that's going on around you. And, you know, you got to be the biggest communicator. You've got to, you know, tell guys to come in. Guys that, like Toumani Kamara, who are picking up 94 feet for 48 minutes, you know, you got to tell him if a screen's coming on his left or right side so he doesn't get hit and hurt. And, you know, offensively, you know, there's times where bigs are just turning their head, looking around, and there's opportunities for me to just sprint to the rim. You know, it's space to four. Sometimes, you know, the guards find me for, you know, open dunks, but, you know, running the floor is just, it's just really important as a big, because, you know, it helps you, it gives you an advantage in so many different areas.
We talk a lot about Wemby and how he's deterred shots, like the, oh no, like I'm not going in against Wemby. Can you sense that with your own game? Is that guys are driving into the lane and then making a business decision and just like, I'm just going to dribble this one out and restart the offense?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes I feel like, you know, if I'm set up down there, hands up, ready to wall up, you know, I feel like there's times where guys would dribble out, pass to the next guy. You know, like I said, I'm just working on trying not to foul, you know, staying light on my feet, moving my feet, and like you said, just deterring every shot that comes in my area.
Yeah, Thiago Splitter being the interim head coach for you guys and having the ability to have a center who's won a championship as your head coach. Is it weird having a coach looking eye to eye with you that you're like, oh, you and I are like the same height? He's not quite 7 feet. I don't know if he is quite 7 feet.
He's up there. He's up there.
But can you talk to what that's like, having Thiago Splitter, an NBA, an international star, an NBA championship winning head coach who's also your size?
Yeah, I feel like it's nice because he's been in my situation before. You know, he's seen the things I'm seeing, and, you know, he's able to give me, you know, tips and advice when things aren't going right or things need to change. And I feel like that is one of the biggest things that has really helped me, you know, having him as a coach, because he knows what I'm going through. He knows, he's been there. He's won at the highest level. So, you know, it's really nice being able to have a big man as a coach.
Yeah, and he clearly wants to win a championship here with the Blazers organization, and you do too. I mean, you won the state championship at Bristol Central. You were undefeated, I think, your senior year in high school, right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Junior year, yep.
You won two championships at UConn. How badly do you want to win a championship in the NBA level? Because we're approaching the play-in tournament right now, and so it's going to be your first taste of that.
I mean, that's the ultimate goal at the end of the day, is to win championships. You know, there's no better feeling in the world than winning. You know, those 2 years of college, just winning a national title, like, there's literally no better feeling. And, you know, I feel like that's my dream, is to go on and win as many NBA championships as I can. Obviously, it's focused on one first, but, you know, it's like I said, there's really no better feeling in the world.
Were you watching Monday night's national title game between UConn and Michigan?
We were playing Denver at the same time. Wasn't too thrilled about that, but yeah. I had some score updates. You know, I checked the box score after, watched a couple highlights. I know the boys gave all they got.
I know. It was a hell of a game, man. I was, I was rooting for UConn. I mean, I'm a New England boy. 3 or 4 years
would have been crazy.
I know, right? I mean, still amazing they actually made it. What's your best Dan Hurley story?
Oof. We could be here for a while. you know, I'll never forget. After we won first national title my freshman year, we stay over in Houston. We go back the next day. We do the whole thing and we get back. And then the day after, so 2 days after we won, I go in the facility to get like breakfast or something. And I see Coach Hurley sit in his office. So I walk in his office. I'm like, Coach, what are you doing here? He goes, man, I'm worried about next year. Worried about going to win next year. Got to get guys so we can win next year. I'm like, you know, the guys are still going to be there in like a week. You know, you can take a little break. But, you know, he just his like, I feel like that wore off on me, just his mentality that, you know, what you've done is not enough. You got to keep going. You got to, you know, just learn how to not be satisfied with what you've done. You got to keep wanting to do more, keep wanting to get better, keep wanting to win.
Kev, we were, there was a game, I feel like you've gotten bad luck here, Donovan, with the games, the UConn games happening when you're actually playing. I don't know what's up with that. But the Duke game was happening during the Wizards game where at halftime, I'm getting ready to go back on air, and the whole crowd just goes nuts.
Nuts.
So what were you doing, and how did you keep an eye on the game? And I know you went onto the court to watch it with Denny on the phone with the security guy, but can you walk me through like your decision? Like, I got to go out on the court.
Yeah, no, I mean, because, you know, I go out on the court every game, 4 or 5 minutes left at halftime, get some shots up. You know, I didn't want to change that routine, obviously knowing what the situation was, how much time's left. And I went out there, and one of our security guards was sitting there watching on his phone. So I went over on his phone, and I watched the shot, and I went nuts. And the whole crowd lit up. And literally for, like, the whole third quarter, I just hear people in the stands like, DC, UConn won on a buzzer beater. And I was like, I was just giving a little fist pump in the air. I was excited, man.
That was one of the games of the year. I mean, in any sport. Sure. Oh, my God. I still can't believe it. I still really can't believe it. Wow. That was unbelievable. Donovan, you're an excellent center. You're having a great year. Always rooting for your success, man. And thank you so much for joining both of us today on the podcast. Thank you, dude.
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me.
All right, thanks to Donovan for joining me. Up next, we're talking to Denny Avdia. All right, joining me now from the Portland Trail Blazers, NBA All-Star, Denny Avdia. Denny, how are you?
I'm good. How y'all doing?
I'm doing great today. Appreciate you joining me. The Blazers sent me a gift. They sent me this most improved player of the year, Turbo. What's the story behind this?
It's kind of a small board, though. It's kind of a small board, but it's nice. Small,
tiny board. What's the story behind this?
You know, it's just kind of the campaign of, like, most improved. I feel like the Blazers are really doing a great job of pushing me and showing me love. And, you know, that's a part of it. You know, they're being creative and helping me just, you know, push my name out there.
When I read this, it says one of three players in NBA averaging 23 plus points per game, 6+ assists and 6+ rebounds per game. When you were in Washington and you're sometimes coming off the bench, not having the ball in your hands as often, did you still kind of have like this vision for yourself to become this type of player? Or were there ever moments where you were like, oh, guess this isn't in the cards for me in the NBA?
I think I was always a solid player. I always thought I have a little bit extra in me. I didn't really see myself like having the ball like majority of the game. Like, I'll be honest with you, like, you know, I was more of like a role player. Like, I did, you know, my job and what I've been asked to do. And then, you know, I was kind of like average or solid in everything. So I was like, I didn't really know where my game's going to take me. And I just try to master my role in Washington, try to be the best I can be. And, you know, I kind of didn't look back. And, you know, I ended up blinking and, you know, here I am.
I mean, early in your career, you're playing with Russell Westbrook. They're bringing in veterans and Bradley Beal's having big years. And like that just felt like the opportunity for you to be that point forward wasn't there. But that's sort of who you were as a draft prospect for Maccabi Tel Aviv. I thought the appeal for you was like, oh, my God, this guy is 6'8", 6'9", can play make with the ball in his hands. It just didn't really manifest early in your career at all.
Yeah, you know, Kev, like I feel like when I first got drafted, I did have the potential, and that's basically what was my role back overseas, but played with some really good players like Russell Westbrook, Bradley Beal. They had the ball a lot in their hands, and I was kind of feeling like the small forward position, you know, just mainly catch and shoot, guarding the best player on the other team, and that was my job. Like, that's what they needed me to do. So I couldn't really have the chance to really have the ball and try to play make, you know. I have some glimpses here and there, but other than that, like, I knew I have that skill, but, you know, sometimes you just get into situations you're not really, you don't really control, you know what I'm saying? So I just try to do my best and try to win and learn and be ready when my opportunity comes.
How has your preparation changed now that you're at the top of every opponent's scouting report?
It changed a lot. I'm watching way more film. I'm watching their tendencies on defense. And I'm probably scouting the defender that's going to guard me, like the other team's best defender. And, you know, it's not easy. A lot of times, you know, I'm coming into games, sometimes back-to-back, sometimes, you know. And you're the head of the scouting report. And, you know, they beat you up. They foul you. And it's not easy. But, I mean, I dream of moments like that, so I can't really complain. You know what I'm saying? Like it's nice to be the kind of like main guy on the scouting report for the other team.
You mentioned drawing fouls. Tari Eason earlier this year said, "What makes you hard to defend is zebras." What's your reaction?
Well, not only I feel like I do get a lot of like criticism about, you know, me drawing fouls, which is completely understandable. I understand it's not the most fun thing to watch or it's not the most aesthetic thing. But, you know, at the end of the day, like I'm a very physical guy. Like I drive the ball the most in the league. I create contact the most in the league. And I feel like, you know, it's just like that's what happens. I mean, sometimes like people who guard me, the best defenders, they're trying to be really aggressive with me. And, you know, part of them being really aggressive with me is giving me easy fouls. So if it's on the table and I can take it, I'll take it. Why would I work so hard? You know what I'm saying? The free throw shot is the most, you know, it's a layup and then it's like, I think a free throw for the most efficient. Well, it depends what player you are, but you know what I'm saying? Like, so I just take what they give me.
For sure. And I mean, also like, it's not like players who are hard to defend are going and living at the free throw line. Like with SGA, people might criticize him for getting the line a lot. It's because nobody can stay in front of him.
I mean, that's a part of it, you know? And, you know, you see all the top players in the league, they're all shooting a bunch of free throws. Like, they get the ball the most. They go to they're driving, they're going to the line, they're breaking the paint. That defines you as a really good player. And, you know, you'll get fouled.
You mentioned how you lead the league in drives. You take 19.4 drives per game. That's first over Jaylen Brown at 19.1, over SGA at 18.9 per game. So that's number one in the NBA, and you're also in the 75th percentile in efficiency on those drives as well, which includes passes out of those situations. When did that flip? The empowerment, getting the ball in your hands, was it last year a conversation with Chauncey? Was it this year with a lack of point guards, the injuries early in the year with Thiago Splitter? When did that flip?
I think it started with Chauncey last year. I feel like last year I didn't really know my role at the team. And then I had like a moment that, you know, I was struggling in the beginning of last year. And then Chauncey came to me and was like, listen, when you grab the board and you can go coast to coast and try to create, it's all you. Do what you do. And then I based a lot of my, like, possessions doing that, just being a transition kind of player and trying to create from transition. then after I did that, like a lot of things opened up for me. Then like my teammates trusted me more. Then I had the ball more on a half court offense. And then, you know, it just like evolved to like having the ball a lot. So it started last year. And then this year, I think I came in with, you know, more responsibility. Like the ball was more in my hands. I had great players around me, but some of them got injured in the beginning of the year. And then they got to figure it out. Like, and, you know, I played a lot with the ball, played a lot of point guard. And my attitude when that happened changed completely, because from being a guy that really looking for aggressively scoring, I was more looking for my teammates and try to get them involved and trying to win games and break the paint. And sometimes it wasn't ending in me. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes I'll just start the game, breaking the paint, making like easy, simple reads, get the guys going, and then the game would open up for me. But that mostly with the things I focused on when the guys were injured. And then now when we're almost in a healthy roster, like I feel like I have kind of like a diverse role. Like I, you know, sometimes I'm more of like scoring. Sometimes I'm more of like playmaking. Like I feel like I'm experienced now to have both things.
I mean, I'm sure that's going to be super beneficial next season with Damian Lillard back. He's going to have the ball in his hands. He can excel off ball as well. What's Damian Lillard going to add to the Blazers next year?
Well, shooting. We can start with that. I think we have really good shooters in the team. I think we weren't as consistent. We're getting better. But, you know, Damian obviously is like a great offensive player, and he brings a lot of threat to the opposing team. And, you know, even him with the ball or even him spacing in the perimeter, it draws a lot of attention. And it definitely helps our team.
You mentioned, you know, kind of that transition, the empowerment you've had over this past year. But you also talked earlier about kind of, you know, playing your role in Washington and maybe not seeing the stardom, being able to be an all-star quite as much. Was there a moment or a game that you had where you were like, oh, okay, wait a minute, I can actually do this?
I don't know if it was a moment. It was like at the beginning, I thought I can have good games. I didn't really think I can do it every night. Like that's what defines good from great. And when I kind of looked back like midway through the season, I'm like, damn, like it's pretty consistent. Like I'm, you know what I'm saying? I had bad games here and there. Like, you know, everybody has off nights. But mostly, I'm looking back, I'm like, damn it. I mean, it's pretty consistent. I'm getting to the line. I'm creating for my teammates. Like we're doing good as a team. Like there's something special that is here that I can't just ignore. And I feel like it was just like looking back midway and just seeing, you know, seeing like the tape and seeing me consistently doing things I do and make me understand it. Okay. Like, maybe it's not a fluke. Maybe it's something real.
What's the biggest hole in your offense right now that you need to improve?
Oh, I got a lot to improve, especially coming back from the injury. My shot has been less consistent as of late. I feel like just kind of like a lot of different solutions now when people are really sitting on my right hand and trying to send me left and being very physical with me. And sometimes, you know, I won't get the call. Sometimes I'm aware that, you know, in playoff games and in harder games, it's going to be harder to go to the line. So maybe a little in between game or some solutions that I can go to if I really need to, and just maturity, like, you know, late game situations. You know, it's also, I'll be honest with you, Kev, like this is the first time I've been in those situations. Like it wasn't like I was 19 as a rookie and getting through like having the ball most of the time and lose games and win games. Like, this is the first ever time that I really have a responsibility. So I'm learning on the fly as well. Like, you know, nobody like I wasn't ready for that. So I feel like I still have a lot to improve, which gets me really excited. But yeah, mostly those things I mentioned. Maybe less turnovers because I turn over the ball quite a bunch. So.
I mean, I think it speaks to how everybody's developmental trajectory is so different. right? I mean, like, you're still only 25. There's still plenty of time to continue improving your game into your late 20s and early 30s, for that matter, adding layers to your offense. And I think that's true. Just to put some numbers behind what you said about the jumper, prior to the back injury in early January, you were shooting 40.5% on catch and shoot threes. That's dropped to 23.1% on catch and shoot threes.
You heard me saying those numbers.
I know, but I'm just saying. You were on fire earlier in the year.
But you know what? I'm not stressing about it because I'll be honest with you. Like, I think I'm a good shooter. I think I've made tough shots. I made good shots. Like I know that it's going to come back. Like, it's nothing for me to worry. I'm going to keep shooting. I'm going to keep putting the work. And, you know, eventually it's just going to loosen up. You know, I've had like a not an easy back injury that kind of like got me out of rhythm. And I'm aware of it. And, you know, I'm kind of getting back to my rhythm on the fly. So,
yeah, I mean, it's the type of thing where, you know, injuries happen. You're still producing. It's just that one area of your game you've had to kind of work around, adapting to it, right? I mean, isn't that kind of part of what makes a player, like the difference between good and great? Everybody's dealing with something, but being able to still produce and adapt while dealing with injury.
So that's the positive thing I'm looking at. Like, sometimes I look after the game. I'm like, okay, I'm still doing what I do. We're still playing and winning basketball, and I'm not shooting really efficient. So if I still produce the things I can, and I'm still like, and I hate looking at numbers. I hate to look at the numbers, but, you know, let's say I produce the average amount of points that I usually do without the 3-point shot. That means that when the 3-point shot is going to be more in rhythm and I'm going to shoot better threes, that means everything's going to open up back again. It's going to be even better. So I'm happy that I'm still being able to kind of get to my spots and be effective. And that's the kind of the positive I'm taking out of it, I guess.
Early this season, the Portland Trailblazers were pressing on like 20% of possessions. It's just like absurd outlier number compared to the rest of the league. What was that like, playing that highly aggressive style, especially earlier in the year?
It was kind of our mentality beginning of the year. It's like Chauncey started to kind of like put in our minds, okay, we're gonna mess up the game. We're gonna full court press. Everybody's gonna full court press. We're gonna be that team that nobody wants to play versus. Like, we're gonna be that annoying team, kind of like what OKC is doing. Like, and I feel like it just continued, you know. Thiago was on the same path, and, you know, he's doing a great job of like putting us in place and like get us motivated, and, you know, and we're just trying, you know. It's not easy for 82 games, like pressing full court and, you know, doing all that for 82 games. It's impossible but you want to have that mindset, you know what I'm saying? You don't want to back off. Obviously, some nights you're going to be less effective and people are going to be more tired. But in the end of the day, if you have that mentality, it's just going to be more consistent.
What's it been like to see Donovan Clingan add the 3-pointer to his game?
Awesome. Awesome, especially that, you know, I came here, he was shooting like less than a 1-3 a game. And he really, really put himself together, like in terms of like physicality, and like he always had that feeling for the game that you can't teach. But, you know, adding a 3-point line that kind of like make big guys go out to you, it's a big plus for a team. And it really makes it easy for, you know, us as a team to create offense, because people are scared of him right now, like from the 3-point line. And he's working hard, he cares, and I'm just happy. And I think he still has a lot of room to grow. So,
oh, for sure. I mean, I think Clingan has potential to be one of the better centers in the NBA, already one of the better defensive centers, and still growing offensively. And that's the thing that's so exciting about you guys. It's like Scoot misses the start of this year. He still retains potential. Like Tumani Kamara, the development he's experienced as on the offensive end, he's not just a defensive stopper anymore. I mean, up and down the roster, you guys are young, but already really competitive. This is like a good place to be. I mean, you want to be competing for championships and you're in the playoffs potentially, but like, it's a good place to be with this young group, I'm sure.
Oh, it's awesome. First of all, before we're talking about the talent, like the human beings on the team, like I'm just being like having fun being around them and compete with them. And, you know, even when things don't go as well, like they're really good and kind of, wait, English. they're really good and just like being humble and hardworking, and nobody's feeling like he's above somebody else. Like everybody's in like looking at each other at the eyes, which I really love about this team. And as I said, you've seen teams before, you know, like the Detroit Pistons, like OKC, that weren't as good, but they had the talent, and you know, it's one click and like they're in a whole different seed. You know what I'm saying? So I think we're in a good path. We definitely have the talent. We definitely have the people to do it. And I feel like it's just a matter of time until like it really, really clicks and we're really going to do something special.
What are you going to remember most from your time in the All-Star game?
Wow. I think my first All-Star being in LA was a little harder because it draws a lot of attention and a lot of people were there. What would I remember the most? I think just my name being called. It happened so fast, you know, it all happened so fast. And it's awesome that I really had the chance to experience that. Like, I hope I'm going to have more All-Stars to experience, but the first one is definitely special and sometimes overwhelming. Like, you know, you weren't ready for that. You know what I'm saying?
When did you realize, oh, wait, Wemby's serious?
I think just from the get-go. We really wanted him to kind of like be good, you know, like most of the plays were on him and, you know, we were just like, let's feed him the ball. If like, you know what I'm saying? If he felt like he really wanted it, so we weren't really there to stop him.
Would you be in favor of a one-on-one tournament in future All-Star weekends?
I don't know. If the fans would love it, like, so why not? I mean, sure, I guess.
You're like, what's the cash prize? That's probably, I mean,
that's what I'm saying. Like, what do we benefit from it, you know?
Yeah, there has to be some type of,
there has to be something. Incentive. There has to be like, you know, gonna be in the middle type of thing.
Otherwise, like, guys are just setting themselves up for potential embarrassment.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you gotta be really confident to be in those one-on-one things, like one-on-one things.
For sure. Are you a one-on-one player? I mean, I would imagine so, right?
I got some. When I play one-on-one, it's different than I play in a game. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't really, my game isn't really like ISO, like crossing over everything. I have it. I can do it. It's just like right now, I'm just doing what I'm good at. That's why we talk about like expanding in the future and like being like right now, I'm doing the things I'm good at. And the things the team wanted me to do, and I'm trying to play winning ball. But I have some game.
Throughout your upbringing, playing for Maccabi Tel Aviv, you're playing with older guys, you know, grown men with families. How valuable was that experience when you were just a teenager?
I think it built a lot of character for me. You know, being 16, playing with mature guys and getting beat up almost every day. And getting hazed is it builds your confidence and it builds your like I'm gonna say I wasn't surprised when I came to the league. You know what I'm saying? It didn't shock me because I already experienced it. You know.
You mentioned getting hazed. Jason Quick from The Athletic and his story had the anecdote about the hickey.
Oh, I didn't know if I should have shared that like. Story, but I felt like it was funny and it was such a long time ago. So
what is the story?
No, I don't want to. No, we're done with it. We're done with it. It's behind me now.
Well, I'll just ask you this.
Yeah.
Was your face turning red? Was the embarrassment visible?
100%. The first time, it happened, yeah. But then most of the practice, they were just.
Oh, it happened more than one time? You're that much of a ladies' man?
Every time I scored.
That's amazing.
There's the lover boy.
Are you a ball buster with your teammates, or like what kind of guy are you at? Like around your teammates?
I'm a rage baiter.
Okay. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Like I give crazy takes just to like get people mad. You know what I'm saying?
You're like a keyboard warrior, right?
No, but sometimes my takes will be valid. You know what I'm saying? Like the other day, I had a conversation about Eminem being a top 10 rapper of all time. And, you know, a lot of the guys were like, nah, he's top 20, he's top 30. I'm like, guys,
he's top 10.
Well, for me, it is, he is too. Like, he changed, like, hip-hop culture, like, around the world. So I'm just, you know, but everybody got their own. Now we're talking about who I like to listen to. So if you're not an Eminem fan or you don't like to listen to Eminem, you're probably, he's probably not a top 10 for you.
I mean,
there's a lot of great rappers out there. I'm just saying that got people really going. Now we're talking about, like, you know what I'm saying? So that type of conversations, like, I talk a lot with my teammates in the treatment room and just get people going.
But, like, the back-to-back album start of his career, Slim Shady, Marshall Mathers, the Eminem Show, and Encore, I think, and, like, just back-to-back bangers.
You don't need to convince me, Kev. Like, you don't need to convince me.
any other hotter takes you want to share about basketball or non-basketball?
I always trying to remember, like, what I told myself. If I had a chance to say it, I would say it, but I can't remember. I had my take that wedge salad is not a salad. That it's like a big one.
Wedge salad is not a salad, but salad's in the name.
I mean, yeah, but when you, I mean, if you, when you see it on your plate, it doesn't look like a salad, is it?
I mean, it's lettuce, right? It's like iceberg.
Okay, so
lettuce,
everything. Okay, so I'll just put a vegetable on your plate. This salad.
Well, vegetables are vegetables.
Okay, but I'm saying, like, it's not a salad. Like, lettuce full of, like, dressing on it and a little bit of tomatoes is not a salad.
But what if you just break it up, you cut it open, and then it becomes, like, smaller pieces? Then it looks like a salad.
Okay, then you make it a salad. You see, you'll fit right in our locker room.
This is your version of, is, like, as a hot dog, a sandwich. Right, that's your version of it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. Yeah. I guess it is. It's not a sandwich though for me. So,
I mean, it's just a hot dog. It's a hot dog. Yeah. It's its own kind of category. Denny, appreciate you joining me today on my show. Best of luck rest of this season. Best of luck in the play-in, getting into the playoffs.
Thank you.
Always enjoy watching you play. Always enjoy watching Blazers broadcast with my buddy Tom Haberstroh on there as well. So say hi to Tom, and I'll say hi to Tom tomorrow. Record the pod with him.
Thank you so much, Kev. I really enjoyed.
Thank you, Denny. Have a good day.
Have a good one.
Thank you to Tom Haberstroh, Donovan Klingon, and Denny Avdia for joining me on today's episode. That was a fun one. A lot of stuff happening in the NBA right now. I still can't stop thinking about the GM idea with the top three odds being lower than the group after that. I'd be curious about what you think. Leave a comment in the Spotify comments or the YouTube comments, what you think about those concepts discussed to help lottery reform. I'm very intrigued. I think the NBA is moving towards something that actually makes sense. Thanks again to you guys for giving us a listen. Thanks to Emmy for producing today's episode. Thank you to Father John Misty for the music. Have a good weekend, everybody. We'll be back again on Monday. Season's over. It's all wrapped up. Playing right around the corner. We're going to be recapping all of it. Can't wait. Playoffs in a week. Woohoo! Can't wait. Have a good one, everybody.